You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Whether it's who they vote for or who they marry, today's young adults, the so-called millennials, are very different from their parents and grandparents. Joining me now for a look at how these generational differences are affecting our economy, our government, and our lives is Paul Taylor. He's Executive Vice President of the Pew Research Center, where he oversees the Social and Demographic Trends Project and the Hispanic Trends Project. His book, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, is published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
So how big are each of these generations, the baby boomers and the millennials?
Well, we know how big the boomers are. They're about 76 million, and at the time they were born, they were a huge generation. And until the millennials came along, they were our biggest generation. The millennials, we don't really know how big they are because we don't know when they end. Every generation sort of gets defined in late teenagehood or early adulthood. We define, you can have different boundaries. The Pew Research Center says millennials were born after 1980. So the oldest of them are now actually getting into their early 30s. I don't know, is a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old a millennial, or is he or she somebody different? We'll find out. But we guess the generation is about 80 million, so it's a little bit bigger than the boomers.
And how? I was always told the boomers were the biggest ever. Now, how long did the boomer generation last? It started after World War II? And
it's a very dramatic. If you look at the fertility rates throughout history, they drop. You go to the early part of our history, and the typical woman has six or seven babies. That goes down, down, down. Fertility rates have gone down throughout every society over the last several centuries. With one exception was the baby boom. So it starts right after World War II. The GIs come back home. America has won. America is prosperous. They make babies, and babies and babies and babies. So it goes from 1946, and it ends almost as abruptly as it starts in 1964 when the birth control pill comes on the market.
And when the Vietnam War starts, in a way.
Well, the Vietnam War started. The Vietnam War was a very important marker for the boomers in that it was part of their coming of age experience. By the time the Vietnam War comes along, a lot of those early boomers were in high school, they were in college, they were under the threat of draft, and we remember the turbulent times then.
From your description, these two generations, the boomers and the millennials, couldn't be more different if they tried. From what they look like to the families they build to how they see America to how they get information, does that automatically set up a generation gap?
There is the potential, and as the book gets into the fact that our social safety net with all the boomers, 10,000 baby boomers a day are turning 65. 10,000 will turn 65 today, again tomorrow, right on through the year 2030. At the end of that period, we'll have more people on Social Security and Medicare, fewer workers supporting them. The math that created those programs don't work, and we're going to have to rebalance them. That has the potential for a generation war. But as I go into this book, although boomers and millennials are different in the ways you've described, they actually like each other. This is part of the drama of this. I'm a boomer. I remember in my 20s. I loved my parents, but I remember that there was a whiff of generation war in the 60s. You guys screwed everything up. Thank God we're along here to make it right. The millennials, even though they've in many ways gotten dealt a much worse hand from the economy, don't point a finger of blame at mom and dad or grandpa, in part because a lot of them are actually still living with mom and dad because that's the only place you can go when you can't find a job.
Now, there are other generations around. There's the silence, born before 1946, and the Generation X, born between 65 and 80.
Right.
Are we seeing as much of a difference between those groups as well?
You bet. The silence are our oldest generation. They're now mostly in their 70s and 80s. Relatively speaking, they're our most financially secure generation. They're our most conservative generation. They don't believe in government, but, boy, hands off their Social Security and Medicare. So that's another potential source of friction here.
And I wonder how that happens, because they lived during the time of the big post-war boom. And they saw when government really was deeply involved and the tax rate was really high, do they not recognize that that actually was a good time for the United States?
Well, I think so. I think
just not now?
Yeah, they look to the past. They believe more so than any generation. We have a question, do you think America is an exceptional country and the oldest folks are the ones giving the highest registration of yes to that? Do you believe America's best days are ahead? they're the least likely to say then. It's the younger folks who say, no, our best days are ahead.
President Obama, who won his campaign for re-election because of non-white voters, made up a record 26. They made up a record of 26% of the voters. Why do you say that non-white voters were punching below their weight in 2012?
Well, this is the other drama. So there are two dramatic demographic changes going on. One, a record share of the population is going gray. We're becoming an older population. And the second dramatic change is we're becoming a rainbow nation. So if you go back to 1960, America was 85% white, the population. By 2060, the population will be 43% white. And the millennials are at the leading edge of that change. They're our first generation to be of more than 4 in 10 non-white. They were the biggest source of support for Barack Obama. Mitt Romney got just 17% of the non-white vote. The non-white vote was the biggest share that we've ever had in our history. It constituted, as you say, it was 26% of all voters, but it was 37% of the population. A lot of the non-whites in this country are still too young to vote. Many of them are not yet citizens. But all of that is going to change. If you look at kids born today, more than half are non-white.
Are they likely to vote? Because we've often seen in the past that members of minority groups were less likely to vote.
Right.
Even when they had the opportunity.
And in 2012, blacks voted at a higher share than whites, first time in our history. And it seems to me, with the immigration issue, what is driving our movement towards a rainbow nation is not so much the increase in the black population, it's Hispanics and Asians. They have something to vote about, which is immigration reform. Their voting patterns suggest that they are moving in that direction. And listen, this is what immigrants have done through our history. The political process draws them in, and they figure out this is a way to plant your flag.
Well, people like Ann Coulter say that the Democrats support immigration reform because it will mean more people will vote for their party.
Yeah, I've heard that, and I've heard the Republicans say, well, one reason why we can't support immigration reform is you want to provide a pathway to citizenship to 11 million Democrats? That is surely a short-sighted view, and I think most of those top leaders of the Republican Party understand that, starting with the entire Bush political family. They have two governors in Florida and Texas. They understand the power of the new Americans.
But many political commentators and some of the Republican Party leaders have said that the GOP needs to find a way to appeal to Hispanic voters. Is that going to be essential to their electoral success in the future?
You look at the numbers, and it absolutely is. I mean, currently Hispanics are 17% of the population. By mid-century, they'll be 30%. Listen, there's an interesting history here. Ronald Reagan runs for president. He comes from California, a state that has seen Hispanic immigration for decades, if not centuries. And he said of Hispanics, they're Republicans who don't know it yet. And he was applying, I think, a 20th century template to how immigrants come to this country. As they arrive as minorities, they look to the Democratic Party, the protector of minorities. As they succeed and as they advance, they are more comfortable with the traditional values of the Republican Party. Well, 30 or plus years later, the Hispanics have become not less Democratic but more Democratic, suggesting that the modern Republican Party hasn't found a way to speak to these new immigrants.
And I heard the same thing about African Americans, that many of them are socially conservative.
Correct.
And so eventually they would wind up voting for the Republican Party, but that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Because the Republican Party hasn't convinced them that it is their friend?
I think that's right. They don't speak in language that suggests an understanding of their lives. And the leading Republicans have made this critique. Listen, the Republican Party right now is going through a needed civil war. They lost an election in 2012, given the headwinds of, 4 years of high unemployment, that there was every reason for them to win. It wasn't even that close. And it was because they got 17% of the non-white vote, and this is we are on our way to becoming a majority non-white country. At some point, they look at these numbers and they say, I quote the German playwright who had a puckish comment about his government years ago when it faced the same thing. Maybe they need to dissolve the public and elect a replacement. Well, you can't dissolve the public, so you have to find a way to talk to it.
So is this good news for the Democrats?
Yes and no. Because
predictions on the next election, the Democrats are not going to do all that well despite all these changes.
Sure, and the Democrats tend to do better in presidentials than off years because you get a bigger turnout. and certainly of young people and of minorities as well. And the truth is, the Democratic Party happily, if you look at popular vote, there's already been good news for the Democratic Party. They won 5 out of the last 6 popular vote elections, and they do look to be demographically ascendant. But their multiracial base could develop fissures. I think there are very challenging issues around rebalancing the social safety net. You may lose some support there. And the ball bounces and the pendulum swings. That's the nature of politics.
My guest is Paul Taylor. He and the Pew Research Center have put together a book called The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown. Did the financial meltdown affect millennials differently than other generations?
Yes. I mean, you think of the oldest millennials are now in their early 30s. So 6-7 years ago, they're just coming out of school and they're just starting their financial lives, and kaboom, everything collapses. So we have the highest share since we've been keeping records of adults then in their 20s who either were unemployed or not even in the job market. For those small number of young adults who may have bought houses before the bubble burst, they surely bought houses at pre-bubble inflated prices. They're the ones who found themselves underwater. So, I mean, we look at all sorts of economic measures, and we can compare today's young with yesterday's young, and they're doing much worse. At the same time, if you compare today's old with yesterday's old, they're doing better.
Well, there was the promise of America was always there was a job there for you, whether you graduated from high school or you went on to college.
Right.
Now the feeling is if you don't go on to college, you're unlikely to get a job. We don't have manufacturing the way we used to. Blue-collar jobs are disappearing. Union jobs are disappearing, so salaries are lower. And this is all having a major impact on the millennials?
Oh, a massive impact. We did a report last month called The Rising Cost of Not Going to College. Now, we'll get back to the rising cost of college in a second. But we compared the economic outcomes of today's 25 to 33-year-olds, the oldest of the millennials, and by their educational attainment. And we found a much bigger gap today than in generations past between how well you're doing if you have a high school degree versus a college or more. If you have a college degree, your unemployment rate in that group is only about 4%. High school or less, it's 12% because, as you say, those jobs are gone. But the kids with the college degree are starting out with something very different than their parents' generation did, which is this enormous albatross of student loan debt. So now about 2/3 of kids with college degrees have such debt. In the past, it was only about half. And the typical college kid has nearly $30,000 worth of debt, about double what it was the case just a generation ago.
Well, I have a college degree, but it's been my experience that nobody ever checked, nobody ever cared. And if I had been able to fake it as an autodidact, I still would have had pretty much the same life that I've had. That's no longer the case.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the penalties for not getting an educational credential in a knowledge-based economy are bigger than they have ever been.
Haven't the economic changes affected all generations?
Yes, they have.
Older people have also lost their jobs.
There's no question. And I don't want to make it sound as if life is hunky-dory for older people. I think there's we can see this in our own surveys. We can see it in the economic data. Most of those boomers who are turning 65 are not as fortified for the journey into retirement as they hoped they were. The 401k system for some people has worked out very well. For most, has not. Social Security and Medicare, they're meant to be your entire income. They're meant to be a floor. They do a terrific job of providing a floor. But there's a tremendous amount of economic anxiety up and down the age ladder. But by any measure you look at, the older folks are doing relatively better.
Job growth has been either high-wage or low-wage jobs, not much in the middle, because of what we've been hearing, a shrinking middle class.
Yeah, and it's, I quote a quip in the book. You talked about the declining manufacturing base. So the factory of the future is going to have just 2 workers, a man and his dog. The man is there to feed the dog. And the dog is there to make sure the man keeps his hands off the equipment. So we have lost a whole category of jobs, not just the classic manufacturing job, but frankly a whole lot of sort of white-collar clerical jobs that computers can do much better. So this is an interesting challenge because, the magic of America for 200-plus years is we're an enormously heterogeneous society. And one of the glues that keeps us together is a big, broad middle class with lots of on-ramps. Well, the middle class has, in fact, gotten smaller. The on-ramps have gotten more difficult to navigate. And this then raises a question not just about economic well-being, but about social cohesion.
What about just where you live, whether you're a boomer, a millennial, or any other group? I just received an email today informing that New York is the most efficient city in the country. L.A., I think, is number four, in fact. Efficiency would play a role in all of this as well, wouldn't it? It would also mean better job opportunities?
Well, sure. I mean, listen, there are hot economies and there are attractive economies, and big cities these days serve as magnets for young people. You go back 40, 50 years and everybody wanted to go out and live in the suburbs. Nowadays, the cities of economic...
They don't want to live in Williamsburg.
Yeah, yeah. But there's another change in terms of where you live, which I think is part of our politics, which is some clever person called the Big Sort. You know, we know how polarized our political system is, and we know how those congressional districts send people to Washington who don't have any incentive to compromise because they know that they represent a deep red or a deep blue district. Some of that is gerrymandering, but frankly, more of it is people finding like-minded people to live with. So it's not that the public, the voting public has become more polarized. It's that they have done a better job of sorting themselves into like-minded communities that then create political parties that reflect not the center. And the paradox here is the American public, by and large, are not ideological. They are pragmatic. This is a country that's done very well because it's made up of people who just wanted, let's solve the next damn problem and stop fighting over ideology. And yet you have now a Congress that represents a sorted public, and all the incentives are to play to the base, and it's very hard to get anything done.
Because of our primary system and also because of gerrymandering.
No, I think gerrymandering plays a role, but I think it's a relatively small role. I think it is this sorting, it is people finding each other, maybe using new and better information. So you say, the kids want to live in Williamsburg. They have more information now that why Williamsburg is the place for them than they may have 10, 20, 50 years ago.
Paul Taylor is the executive vice president of the Pew Research Center, where he oversees demographic, social, and generational research, author of a number of books, the most recent, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, published by Public Affairs. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Paul Taylor, who is a former reporter for The Washington Post, where he covered presidential politics and served as a foreign correspondent. Now he's the executive vice president of the Pew Research Center and oversees demographic, social, and generational research. The latest book to come out of that is The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, published by Public Affairs. And does this also grow out of your experience as somebody who covered the White House and foreign affairs?
A little bit. Most of it, I would say, I've been at the Pew Research Center 10 years. I would say most of it is a culmination of the work there. We are a mix of former journalists like myself and serious social scientists, and the special sauce we try to create is the methodological rigor of social science, whether it's public opinion surveys, whether it's economic or demographic data analysis, and then the storytelling skills of people like me who try to find the stories and the numbers.
Millennials are the first generation to grow up with a lot of the technology that we use today. How does that affect their career prospects?
I'm not sure. It's a great question. I can tell you how it's affected some of the ways that they are navigating adulthood. We just put out a report day before yesterday on that called Detached from Institutions, Network with Friends. So if you look again at the millennial generation, we describe again as 18 to 33-year-olds, they are the least affiliated with political parties, with organized religion, and with marriage.
And yet they seem to have liberal attitudes.
It's not that they don't have opinions and views. And we know from their voting patterns, they are what we would describe as very liberal. No question they were a big Democratic voters, but they simply don't affiliate with the established institutions and anchors that we associate with the journey into adulthood. So how do they organize their world? Well, they are the first generation of digital natives. They organize their world with the things they hold in their hand. They create social networks. They have the power to place themselves at the center of those networks. The selfie is a nice example of that. And it's just a different way of engaging. And so there's an interesting question, and I'll leave it to people smarter than me. Is it better? Is it worse? I don't know, but I sure know it's different.
Well, I do know a number of young people who are creating their own apps because they don't have jobs and they might as well be doing this.
Right.
Entrepreneurship seems to be bigger mainly because they have no other option.
I think that's right. Although we had a conference in D.C. yesterday that was mulling over some of this, and it's not clear just how entrepreneurial this generation is. This generation is very low on social trust. There's an interesting question as to why that is, whether it was the kind of nurturing, overprotective parenting, or whether a heavy number of them are non-white. And historically, people who are minorities or people at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale don't it's risky to trust others if you're not well fortified to deal with the consequences of misplaced trust. So I would say, based on the markers that we look at, you might describe them as a little bit of a risk-averse generation.
Well, what about the revelations of the NSA through Edward Snowden? Would that make them even more mistrustful?
I think they know Big Brother is watching, and they are trying to organize their online lives as best they can in a way to take advantage of that in the best way, which is, you know, the typical millennial has 250 Facebook friends, or he or she needs to manage the reputation with those friends, maybe ward some of them off. Some of them get some information, and others get different information. It's a complicated world, and they're kind of writing the rules.
Well, since they don't register with a party, that would mean that they don't have much impact on the candidates. They just have the candidates said that the previous generations have given them to vote for.
Typically, you know, adults in their 20s and 30s don't have much institutional inside party clout. That tends to be something that happens a little bit later in the life cycle. You get married, you settle down, you start paying taxes, you worry about your kids' schools and all the rest. So I think that's out there in the future. But let me give you one statistic. In 2012, millennials were 18% of the voters on election day. Excuse me, they were 26% of the electorate, age-eligible electorate. By 2020, they will be 38% of the age-eligible electorate. So, boy, the politicians need to pay attention to them.
My guest is Paul Taylor, not the dancer, but a man who knows an awful lot about how our country works. His latest book, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, published by Public Affairs. What about gender roles? Do millennials see them differently than their predecessors?
Absolutely. This is one of the most fascinating revolution going on. And we know the statistics. Almost 6 in 10 of undergraduates are now women. It's a reversal from 20 or 30 years ago. When we do surveys of young adults and say, what's important to you in your life looking ahead, and these are kids in their 20s, more women now than men say it's important for me to be successful in a high-paying career.
So they're more focused on career than they would have been in the past.
Gender roles are converging and changing both at work and at home.
But why are men less so?
Men are having a much more difficult time adjusting to a knowledge-based economy. You know, throughout human history, men had the advantage of more strength, and a lot of jobs were built on strength. There was a great quote. It was an Onion parody of one of our reports, and we now have, you know, a growing number of women now out-earn their husbands, and this is a little tough for men to take. And the Onion did a quote interview with a man on the street, and he says, you know, Once my wife develops the upper body strength to open those difficult jars, I'm out of here. So, you know, and you know, this is an unfair depiction, but the popular culture now has the male slacker, a lot of movies, you know, you can't get lunch, still living on mom's home, on mom's couch. So I think gender roles are converging. I think the new rules are being written. I think romance in your 20s is really complicated. That's one, and we know from the statistics of 20 somethings today, only 1 in 4 are married. If you go back a generation ago, 55-60% were married. So marriage is now much further off in the distance. Why most kids say I want to get married? Why not? I'm not a good marriage prospect. I don't have a job. I can't be a good provider.
And some are not getting married at all. But wasn't that also true of Generation X?
less so. I mean, in some ways, Generation S gets a little bit lost in these analyses because they're a little bit of a smaller generation. But in almost all the attitudinal and behavioral and economic measures we look at, Generation X is kind of a bridge, and you see the changes through them. I think Generation X, at least in the popular literature, is in fact a more entrepreneurial generation, and whereas I think there's another line about the millennials that I heard at this conference that struck me as exactly right. They are nice. They like their parents and grandparents. They like each other. They collaborate well at work. And someone would say, Jimmy Fallon, off to a great start. He himself is not a millennial, but he knows where the market is. And to older folks like me, we've always associated late night humor with some bite, with some sarcasm. And he's Mr. Nice, and he's getting ratings through the roof. So there is a zeitgeist change here.
But aren't Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert also very popular with the younger people?
They are indeed.
And they have the bite.
They do have the bite. But the fact that the mainstream guy who's, Jon Stewart is great. I'm going to be on his show tonight. But in terms of the mainstream culture, those big boy shows tell us something about who we are.
Despite the millennials, the American population is aging. Is that in part because life expectancy has gone up so much? What is the median age in this country compared to around the world?
Median age here is higher than a lot of the developing countries, but not nearly as high as some of our economic competitors. This is one of the great dramatic demographic changes in human history. We are heading for an era where all the growth in the population is going to be among the old, not the young. The growth of the young over the next 50 or 100 years will almost come to a halt. By the middle of the century, our median age will go up a little bit. It'll be our highest ever at 41. Japan's will be 53. Germany's will be 52. China's will be 46. A lot of the growth in the median age is, yes, increased life expectancy, but a lot of it is declining birth rates. So we put those two things together.
That's because people are getting married later.
It's not only because, yes.
And having fewer children.
And having fewer children because, you go back from most of human history, why did you have a lot of kids? Well, first of all, you weren't sure all of them would survive into adulthood because we had terrible sanitation and we didn't have good medical care and all the rest. And you needed to have a lot to make sure some of them would be around to take care of you in your old age. Well, now we have public systems to provide that support. We have better health care. People are confident. And we have the changing role of women. So nowadays, if a woman wants to become a mother, there's an economic cost there that didn't used to exist 50, 100, hundreds of years ago.
And baby boomers now are becoming, as you said earlier, eligible for Social Security, Medicare at a very high rate, 10,000 a day. The system, we often hear the system has to be fixed because of the demographic changes. Does it really have to be fixed?
It absolutely has to be fixed. And it's one of the tragedies of our gridlock political system that neither party can find its way to taking this on. You don't want to get too far into predicting the future because stuff happens.
But well, I was told it was going to be dead by now when I started doing this show.
Right.
Conservatives would come on and say it's over.
Right.
The tipping point is 2010 or 2005.
Right. All right. Well, so the tipping point, it depends on which program, but it's either 2016 for the disability program, 2026 for Medicare, 2033 for Social Security. These are in the foreseeable future. And the problem with waiting until they come is that the longer you wait, the more the burden of any solution will fall on the already overburdened younger generation. So this younger generation coming in, the millennials, they're now far enough in adulthood to be able to say this. They are the first generation in modern history that is doing worse economically than their parents.
But yet the generations are interdependent, and today's workers are paying for the benefits that today's seniors are receiving, despite the fact that they're earning less.
That's right. So there is a profound question of generational equity here. There's a long history of Social Security. It was sort of sold as a pre-funded system. You put your money in, the government holds it for you with a little bit of interest, you get it back. People love that idea, but that's really not the way it works. The way it works is today's workers pay for today's retirees. If you have more retirees to worker, the old math doesn't work. You have to fix it. If you wait till the crisis comes to fix it, the burden of the solution falls on today's young adults and their children and their grandchildren, already disadvantaged by some of the economic changes that we've been talking about.
Paul Taylor and the Pew Research Center, the book, The Next America, Boomers, Millennials, and the Looming Generational Showdown, published by Public Affairs. Good luck tonight with Jon Stewart. The conversation will be much briefer than this one.
If he's as good an interview as you are, we're going to do just fine. Thank you very much.